All financial advice provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. This hour will help investors fix issues and achieve personal gain. Now, here's your host, Jay Taylor.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm speaking to you from New York City on this first day of December 2020. Before I talk more about today's show, I do like to remind you I am the editor of Jay Taylor's Gold, Energy, and Tech Stocks, a newsletter that's published weekly and monthly, and its focus is primarily on the junior mining sector, not exclusively, but largely so. And it is a very exciting time, especially on a day like today when gold is up around $38 an ounce. The junior shares are having a very nice day. Also like to encourage you to consider signing up for Chen Lin's letter, What is Chen Buying, What is Chen Selling? ChenPicks.com. ChenPicks.com is a place to go for that. And Michael Oliver as well. He's not with us today, but he's here every other week, OliverMSA.com. And I want to thank all of you for listening, making this show one of the more popular shows in the Voice America Business Channel. Also, encourage you to continue sending along any comments you have about this show to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com, questions4taylor@gmail.com. And we do want to thank our sponsors, because without them, there would be no show. Benchmark Metals, NV Gold, Cassiar Gold Corp, Hannon Metals, Irving Resources, Novo Resources, Sitka Gold Corp, Lion One Metals, and SK Mining Corp are the sponsors for this week's show. Before I talk about today's show, I want to pass along some very good news for Hannon Metals, one of our sponsors. The company announced on Monday, yesterday, November 30th, that it has signed a binding letter of agreement for a significant option and joint venture agreement with Japan Oil, Gas, and Metals National Corporation, or JOGMEC for short. That's on Hannon's massive San Martin copper and silver project that has world-class grade and scale written all over it. JOGMEC is a Japanese government independent administrative agency which, among other things, seeks to secure stable resource supplies for Japanese companies. JOGMEC has a strong reputation as a long-term strategic partner in mineral projects globally, and the mandated areas of responsibility for JOGMEC relate to oil, natural gas, metals, coal, and geothermal energy. JOGMEC facilitates opportunities with Japanese private companies to secure supply of natural resources for the benefit of the country's economic development. And under the agreement, JOGMEC has the option to earn upwards to 75% interest in the San Martin project by spending $35 million to deliver a joint venture, a feasibility study. San Martin project covers 656 square kilometers of Hannon's 940 square kilometer Peruvian holdings, and Hannon will continue to progress exploration on its remaining Peruvian projects. So this is, I think, a very, very good move for Hannon. It's a massive project. Obviously, it would require a major mining company with major resources to come in there and explore and develop this, and then no doubt other Japanese mining companies will take an interest in later on as the project develops, assuming it does. It is a very high-grade, very, very large-scale project, and we've talked about it. We will be talking to Hannon again on this show sometime in the near future. Hannon's shares are up some 27% over the last couple of days as a result of this. But even though it's up a lot, its market cap remains very low. It's still only a $32 million market cap. So this certainly remains one of my favorites, personal favorites. It's in my newsletter, of course, and as is Lion One Metals, which I will be talking to Quentin Henning about. in just a few minutes after our first commercial break. I've titled today's show, Reducing Investment Risk Amidst Increasing Chaos. David McElveny will be joining me during the second half of today's show, and as I just mentioned, Dr. Quentin Henning will be with me right after the first commercial break. As we end 2020, a year characterized by growing government tyranny in Western world, in most Western countries anyway, and as the West's financial system spins closer and closer to the abyss, the big question for investors who are aware of the imminent financial danger that we face is what is going to happen in 2021? A growing number of proponents of modern monetary theory, or MMT for short, suggests that all our problems can be solved by central banks creating endless amounts of debt-based money and pumping that credit into the economy. Currently, former Fed chairperson Janet Yellen, who is slated to become a Secretary of the Treasury, is certainly of that mind. But MMT is not modern at all. Essentially, what the geniuses that come out of Harvard, Princeton, and Yale propose now is just a higher-tech version of the disastrous Mississippi Company, and there is no reason to think the current policies of trying to create money out of thin air will end in any better form than did the Mississippi bubble of the early 1700s. That event forced John Law into poverty and a need to flee France for fear of his life after the bubble popped. Like the United States now, the wars waged by Louis XIV left France in a very bad economic and financial shape. France became essentially bankrupt because it didn't have enough gold to back the mountains of paper, money that was created to pay for France's foreign wars. So the death of Louis XIV in 1715 left France's state finances, which were the royal finances, in a state of bankruptcy. The royal debts were 3 billion livres, annual income 145 million, and expenditures 142 million. That meant only 3 million livres were available to pay 220 million livres of interest on the debt. And consequently, the debt, which was equivalent of modern treasury bills, traded at an 80% discount to its face value. But along came John Law, the savior, or so they thought and hoped at that time, who, very much like John Maynard Keynes of the 1930s, suggested that there was no need to restrict the money supply by insisting that it be backed by gold. Like Keynes, who was first a mathematician and secondarily an economist, Law was a successful gambler because he had a mathematical mind that could quickly figure odds. Both men tried to solve a problem rather than understand why it existed in the first place, and so the solution in both Law's mind and in Keynes' mind was to get rid of gold and print as much money as possible and as required to service the debt. Given the dire straits of the French economy was in, when Louis XIV died, John Law weaseled his way into what amounted to be the financial boss of France. Through various means, Law eliminated gold from the French currency. In the near term, the increase in credit-based money that resulted from the detachment of gold seemed to work like a charm, as increased money in circulation resulted in increased trade and apparent prosperity. But that also resulted in a rapid increase in asset prices, which all worked out well, as all Ponzi schemes do, until investors decide to take profits. In the last 3 months of 1720, the French currency lost virtually all its values vis-a-vis the British pound. John Law became a pauper and escaped from France to live in Brussels and then in London, where he died broke. Unfortunately, he took a large number of very innocent people into poverty along as well, as the U.S. Federal Reserve is, in fact, and has been doing for some time to many of millions of Americans that have been called deplorables. Fortunately, for those of you who listen to this show and other shows like this and read articles on the Mises website and other places, perhaps you follow gurus like Ray Dalio, you're aware that there is a need to take your savings out of dollars and put them into gold or silver or some tangible assets that will retain value. And today, with gold up more than $38, it seems that that is starting to happen again in our markets here. And by the way, I should mention that Michael Oliver noted in his weekend missive that any rally now over the three-day average zero line in his work would suggest that the next breakout for gold is underway. Well, wouldn't you know it, today the number was 1795. That was the number we needed to see. And with gold exploding by more than $38 to $1,815 just prior to today's show, that suggests the next major move higher in the yellow metal is in fact underway. Unfortunately, a very large number of Americans don't have enough money to buy assets that can retain their value because Americans, like the French folks who lived during the 1700s, were taught that they could become really wealthy by taking on debt and buying paper assets that have no value underneath them. And I leave with you a question, just a thought, and you could send your response to me if you like. Could Bitcoin be on such a current asset trap, or shares of stocks that are selling at 100 times earnings or more? Well, I would suggest that for a detailed account of the story of John Law and to see how it relates to what is actually taking place now, I would suggest that you Google Alistair MacLeod on John Law to read his article that is posted at the Mises.org website. There is also a couple of videos that I just saw in which Alistair explains the Mississippi bubble and how our current situation is very, very similar to what took place back then. We need to do what we can to learn from history so that we're not doomed to repeat it. Well, we do have to go to commercial break now, but don't go away because Dr. Quentin Henning will be with me right after that to give us an update on Lion One Mines, which is really developing a very exciting project, high-grade gold, very large-scale gold project, we believe, in Fiji. So don't go away. I'll be right back with Dr. Quentin Henning.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
Benchmark Metals is an advanced gold-silver exploration company that is rapidly advancing its Canadian gold-silver project to a production decision. Benchmark is nearing completion of its largest program to date, with up to 100,000 meters of resource expansion and definition drilling in 2020. The multi-million ounce potential project is expected to have a new mineral resource estimate and PEA study completed in 2021. The company is backed by the Metals Group management team and believes this aggressive program will be complemented by one of the strongest commodity bull markets in decades. Visit BenchmarkMetals.com and subscribe to follow their success.
Cassiar Gold Corp. trades on the OTCQB under the symbol CGLCF and on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol GLDC. Its flagship asset, the Cassiar Gold Project, is a large advanced stage road-accessible gold property with an NI 43-101 compliant resource estimate of 1 million ounces at 1.43 grams per ton gold at the Taurus near-surface bulk tonnage gold deposit, and 15 kilometers of high-grade gold prospects. The property hosts several past-producing high-grade gold mines and is in search for the next multi-million-ounce gold camp in British Columbia.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me once again Dr. Quentin Henning. He's going to give us an update today on Lion One Metals. Welcome, Dr. Henning, and thanks so much for joining me again.
Thank you, Jay. Pleasure to be here.
It's always good to hear your voice, and it's always good to let our listeners know about the companies. Just a brief introduction here. Lion won medals. The story has been told here several times in the past, but just for people that might not be familiar, it trades in Canada in the symbol LIO. LOMLF is the symbol you can buy it with in the States. 135.7 million shares, $1.25 in U.S. money a little while ago. Actually, $1.27 now as I look at the screen, and a very nice update for gold. It's a market cap of a little over $170 million in U.S. money. So, Quentin, last time, your view on Lion Mines, you had this view of Lion One's project there in Fiji. You saw it as an alkaline gold deposit, and these are very large projects. They're very large gold, high-grade gold deposits, and you mentioned they're about as rare as hen's teeth, I think is the way you put it.
Yep.
Your view was that that's what actually was there. There was a very high-grade, near-surface gold deposit that looked pretty economic, but it was kind of smallish. But you thought you saw something bigger, and lo and behold, it seems as though your vision of an alkaline deposit is panning out to be the fact. Can you give our listeners a little bit of what the company is planning now with its exploration and what it might be looking forward to and what investors might be looking forward to as we move into 2021?
Sure. Let me actually start with a recap and kind of give a little more detail to what you just introduced. Mm-hmm. So, first of all, Tuvatu, which is the project, is in Fiji. Okay, yep. It's not far from Nandi, which is the large international hub there. It's, in fact, only about 20-minute drive from the international airport up to site. Okay, so it's a very good location. Most people don't realize, but Fiji is a gold mining center. There are gold. There have been gold mines here, and the largest of which is the Vatukoula or the Emperor Mine, as it's called in the old days. And it's produced over 7 million ounces at this point. I believe it has another, resource and reserve of, say, another 4 million ounces. So it is a 10-plus million-ounce gold system. Mm-hmm. Right? These gold deposits, they form in association with what we call alkaline magmas. They're basically molten rock that had a lot of alkali metal, in particular potassium, dissolved in it. And these magmas can carry a lot of gold. So when they come up and they start cooling and crystallizing and so forth, the gold has to go somewhere. And the magmas actually dispel the gold. They flush the gold out. The gold gets concentrated into the fluids that come off the magma. And then they get those fluids and get introduced into the fractures above the magma chain. So you can produce these wonderful high-grade deposits out of these systems. And that's what we have at Tuvatu. So the company, had drilled up a resource a bit under a million ounces, but it was, it's a pretty high-grade resource. And it's all within, say, 350 meters of surface. It's controlled by these narrow structural zones, which, again, are very high-grade. The little fractures that make up the structural zones often are insanely high-grade. Like, you can have percentages of gold in these tiny fractures. All right, so when I saw this, I realized, somewhere down in depth, there have got to be bigger versions of these fracture zones. And that's why we did the work we did last year. We did some geophysics and other techniques, and we targeted the deeper part of the system. We're effectively looking for the trunk or the thicker branches, we'll say, of the tree at depth. So to fast forward, we drilled one hole late last year. It a very nice interval, I believe about 4.3 meters of an ounce per ton. And then this year with COVID, it's been a bit of a challenge to operate, but we managed to drill yet another hole mid-year. I think it was July. We announced a hole where we hit abundant visible gold. When we got the assays back, it was phenomenal. I think it was I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but it was something on the order of, I believe, 12-odd meters of 56 grams per ton gold. It was just insane. That's not a bad result when you're drilling the deep target and you're using geophysics. Okay, so on the first hole of this target, we nailed it. Very encouraging. The company managed to raise some money on the back of that, and quite frankly, looking at the gold space in the past couple of months, that was a very good move. So line one is currently cashed up. It's got about $62 million in the bank. But now we have to lay the stage, you know, for what's to come. Like, how are we going to tackle this?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So the first thing that we started to do, we drilled some wedge holes after hitting that high grade. We drilled two wedge holes, the first of which hit high grade right away. We put those results out. We had several meters of, I believe, 85 grams or something like that. And then we drilled the second wedge. The second wedge, the drill broke down while drilling it, so it was a struggle. We didn't get to finish the entire hole, but we hit about 130 meters of interval where there was just one, you know, vein after another, like just boom, 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 the whole way down. There were a couple, I think two or three high-grade pops in there, but what we could tell is we were basically drilling straight down the hanging wall of the high-grade vein. So we were drilling, you know, sub-parallel to the high-grade vein, and we didn't go across it, but we knew that we were right, snuggle up right next to it, which is fine. But that information then told us the orientation of the vein, mm-hmm. and that was really important. We basically ascertained the thing is trending, call it northeast to north-northeast, and that then allowed us to decide how we're going to drill this thing going forward. Now, here's where it got interesting. So once we found out the thing is going kind of northeastish, the problem is if you drill it at an orthogonal angle, like you want to drill kind of straight at it, mm-hmm. the hill to the east and southeast from this discovery is very steep. It like mm-hmm. they go straight up. All right, so we realized that we could probably sneak a couple pads up there, and we did. We pushed a road up, and we put two drill pads kind of perched up on the toe of this cliff. Mm-hmm. But we realized, you know, pushing any further in that direction was impossible. So we looked at other ways we could drill the doggone thing, and the conclusion we came to was that we could drill it from underground. So there is a decline down the mm-hmm. axis of the deposit. And the decline puts us in a position where we'll probably be drilling it from the north going to the south, or northwest going to the southeast. But it does allow us to drill across the darn thing. Okay, so we had, because that was the decision that we made to drill it from underground, we had to order some rigs. Yep. So we currently have two drills being manufactured. They'll be delivered over the next few weeks. And we're going to start drilling this thing from underground. Now, this is it gives us three benefits. One is that it saves us a lot of meters, because if we're drilling mm-hmm. from underground, we're already closer to the target. Second thing is it allows us to drill at more favorable angles, being a bit lower. It's not like we're sitting there trying to thread the needle from, you know, standing way above the target. We're actually mm-hmm. closer to the target, so we can drill it at more favorable angles. And then lastly, it allows us to drill all year. Okay, the mm-hmm. wet season is coming, and there's a time when it's really difficult to work at surface. So by working underground, we should be able to drill this thing all year, which is really, really good. I mean, that's the best outcome. So look, we're excited. We've had to revamp our exploration program, but we're excited about the fact that we'll now be able to drill this thing fairly aggressively. The two surface rigs that are operating right now are both drilling at the target. Okay, so I don't want people to think everything's offline. They aren't, actually. Mm-hmm. We've got two rigs right now that are in progress, and they're targeting the high grade. They're the two rigs that are perched up on the kind of the toe of the bluff. Okay, mm-hmm. so we're poking two holes down there. I think one rig's at 490 meters thereabouts. I think the target in that particular rig is about around 600, so we're getting close. And then the other rig is down a bit over 100 meters, I believe. And again, the target's about 600 meters, so it's a little ways out. But we should be able to cross that high-grade structure again here soon. I'm hoping we'll have some nice news around that.
Mm-hmm.
I think the separation from where we hit the high grade initially is going to be significant, probably at least 50 meters. So it'll give us our first indication of what this high grade thing is doing at depth.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. That should be, and we might see some news how soon on that, Quentin.
If we hit the thing, the assay turnaround is pretty quick because the lab's right there in Fiji. Mm-hmm. So it shouldn't take too long. I'd say with once we go through the high grade zone, you know, presuming we do, and we get assays, it shouldn't be more than 2 or 3 weeks out.
Mm-hmm. All right. And any idea of how many meters might be drilled, or what are we looking at for 2021?
Look, I think that's really open ended at this point.
Okay.
We can drill underground. We can continually drill. I think it's basically going to be an ongoing exploration program from here on out. So, yeah. I wouldn't cap the number.
Great. All right. And then there is some talk of the company going into production at some point, because after all, it was a very advanced project. They have the permits, I think, to go into production. What are the plans right now on that?
Okay. So, look, I'm not the best person to speak about it, but here's what I can say. I can say that the company is firstly looking at people to bring in. I think they're going to build up their team. They're looking at putting the decline in first. You know, when that happens exactly, I don't have clarity on timing, but I would say they would start a decline, and at the same time, they would then start figuring out the rest of the plan around processing and so forth, like designs and so forth. And then ideally, they would have everything come together, say, within the next couple of years to go ahead and get into production. Now, ideally, that decline should go down to the depth of this high grade. In other words, now that we know the high grade's there, you might as well put your put a few more turns in the decline and get down to that depth and be able to pull that in. So,
yeah. Well, that would be exciting. And so as you could just advance the decline further down towards the juicy good stuff and keep poking holes, I suppose, too, and drilling. And yeah. Oh, that's great. And how well financed is the company, Quentin?
Yeah, the last count I heard, they had 63, and that was after purchasing the putting the payment down for the two rigs they're purchasing.
So. They had 63?
Yep, $63 million.
$63 million. So that should do them okay for next year, I would think.
Easily. Yeah. That's plenty of money.
Very good. Excellent. Well, there's a lot to look forward to here. Anything else? Is that pretty much it? We just have to keep watching, I guess. Huh?
Yeah, keep watching. I think. If everybody's thinking, hey, there's high grade zone here and that's it, I don't think that's it. Okay, I think there's going to be multiple high grade zones down there because the structure's certainly there. So look, we got a lot. This is a story that's just beginning.
It's an alkaline deposit, and as you say, rare as hen's teeth. And when you find one, they're worth an awful lot more than hen's teeth. So
exactly. Yep.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Quentin, for being with us. And the shares are up. I see 6% today on a very strong day for the gold market. So, thanks a lot. Thanks a lot, Quentin, and we'll keep up with you in the future going forward. A very exciting story.
All right. Thank you, Jay.
All right. You bet. Well, okay, folks, we have to go to break, but don't go away because David McIlvaney of the McIlvaney Financial Companies will be with us. And David always has great insights on the markets and a lot more than that. So, David will be right back with us right after the break. Don't go away.
Voice America is available on your Google connected device.
Okay, Google, play Turning Hard Times into Good Times podcast on iHeartRadio.
Try it today.
NV Gold Corp, trading under NVX on the TSX and NVGLF on the OTC, is a gold exploration company focused on uncovering the next multi-million ounce gold deposit in North America. With an aggressive exploration season ahead in 2020, a tight share structure, strong management ownership, key strategic investors including Eric Sprott, a globally recognized technical team, technical coverage from industry gold experts, and cash in its treasury. Visit nvgoldcorp.com to learn more on this exciting story.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, Taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me once again David McElvaney of the McElvaney Financial Companies. David is the president of that of the McElvaney Financial Companies, which includes Wealth Management and ICA. It's a precious metals brokerage firm. And before taking over the business from his father, who founded the McElvaney Companies, David had a very impressive academic background and achieved honors as a top salesman in Southwestern Company, and gained an extensive business expertise with Morgan Stanley in California. But David's life and goals are intentionally about a whole lot more than grabbing all the financial wealth he can get. Certainly, he and his father before him have had a considerable amount of financial success, but David understands that without a godly spiritual dimension, without a spirit of forgiveness and redemption, which allows us to live joyous and productive lives, we can be downright unhappy, and we can cause untold harm to others, no matter how much wealth we have. I'd like to just read a thought that David has put out in a book that he wrote called The Intentional Legacy, and I quote David because I think this is so important beyond the financial stuff we talk about all the time on this show. And David said in the book, and I quote, "Our lives are not our own. Every choice we make will shape the destiny of children yet to be born. Every act of love or hatred, redemption or savagery, thoughtfulness or selfishness, births a future for ourselves and others. We live lives permeated by legacy, the legacy given to us and the legacy we cultivate every waking moment of the day. We are the custodians of a general story. Ours is but one chapter, positioned somewhere in the index of a book of indiscernible length. The narrative begins long before we were born. It continues further into the future than we might imagine. We may not do with our lives whatever we choose. There is a higher call. We are the trustees, the caretakers of our great-grandchildren's future. Our very existence is a gift given by God to be dedicated to His service. That service finds an immediate and practical expression in the context of the life and labor of the family. Our greatest aspirations and highest ideals are reflected in the life we live with our children. It is not enough that our children succeed. We want them also building upon our victories and transcending our defeats. It is our children, not our jobs, which are the most important work of our lives." End of quote. So welcome, David, and thank you so much for joining me again today on Turning Hard Times into Good Times. And I want to thank you so much for the book that you've written, which I think is really an inspiration to me, and I know an awful lot of other people as well. So I just want to thank you so much for coming on the show again today, and I just wanted to share that part of your being with our listeners, because I think it's so important that people keep that in mind, what is really important in life. So thanks again for being with us.
Thank you, Jay, for that warm welcome back.
Yeah, it's always good to have you with me. I want to get your views on the markets in a moment or two from now, but I would like to ask you, how can we apply the ideas of forgiveness and redemption that you talk about in your book in our country when organizations like Black Lives Matter and Antifa are burning down buildings and causing untold monetary and psychological harm to citizens in various cities around the U.S., and when we white folks are sometimes called racist simply because of the color of our skin? It seems kind of hard. I know that we're supposed to be forgiving people, but it's kind of difficult, so I'm just wondering if you can give us some guidance how we can do that.
Jay, that's a big question, and I don't know that I'm fully qualified to answer it. So my opinion is straightforward. There's the history, which is behind us, the present, which we're encountering, and obviously a lot of frustration and a desire for justice. Justice is important. Justice is very important, and I'm certainly a champion for that. But a part of justice is remembering the past rightly. You can have history as it's changed through time. Even if we remember our own lives, there's things that I might remember at age 10, 11, or 12, and the way I remember them isn't necessarily exactly the way they happened. So there's a challenge to get at history so that we are dealing with facts and we are dealing with an acknowledgement of wrongs where wrongs have been done, and it's all right for there to be accountability. I don't know exactly how that works cross-generationally in terms of, you know, something that might have happened 100 years ago, and I'm as accidentally in this story where I am as someone else is, but I certainly want to understand the sense of anxiety and suffering, if it is that someone else experiences. I don't know that I'll necessarily take ownership of things that don't rightly belong on my shoulders, but it is important where there's things that we have done or contributed to that we take responsibility for those actions. I think that's perhaps where my frustration might echo yours. I'm not sure if we can take responsibility for things that go that sort of precede us 100 years or something. Mm-hmm. Like that. So I'm open to the conversation, and I want to be sensitive to what may be a very real struggle for someone else, and may seem minimized from my standpoint only because of how I was raised and where I was raised and whatnot.
Yeah, I agree, and I think it's really good to be introspective, to look inside our own hearts and souls sometimes to try to find out, because it's very easy, not having lived in someone else's shoes, not to see what they see and how they see it. So the importance of being able to live civilly and be able to discuss with people what our beliefs are, and this is one of the things that's broken down so much now, is this ability to discuss civilly with one another and to treat each other with respect. I try to see it as that everybody has been created by God and they're just as worthy as I am. So I think if we can start from that point of view, then it's helpful anyway. So but anyway, go ahead.
A few weeks ago, I had a philosopher, professor of philosophy, on my weekly commentary, and we were talking about the issue of fake news, and we were talking about the issue of partisanship, and we were talking about the need for epistemic humility, where we have to recognize there's some things we know, and there's a lot of things that we don't. And yet there's often claims made to know a lot more than we do. Mm-hmm. And you know, so you see the partisanship, the nastiness, the lack of civility in public discourse, and I think a part of it does deal with this issue of epistemic humility or lack thereof. Mm-hmm. And if we can engage people with a little bit more epistemic humility, a willingness to listen, and that's coming from both sides,
yeah,
a healthy conversation, I think, can be had. It's harder to have right now because people are fairly convinced they have the whole truth and nothing but the truth, and everyone else is 100% wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, if you start with that, then you're not going to get very far. That's for sure. I did listen to part of that part of that episode, by the way, David. And tell our listeners how they can, where can they go to get, because you have a weekly commentary that you do, and it's usually it's at least 30 minutes long, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, 30 minutes to an hour at the most. Typically 30 to 45 minutes. Weeklycommentary.com is the easiest. Mm-hmm. Weeklycommentary.com or McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. Either one will get you there.
I've titled today's show Managing Risks in an Increasingly Chaotic World, and certainly part of what is uncertain right now has to do with politics, and specifically in the United States, at least, with regard to who controls the Senate. Certainly there have been, on the blue side of the aisle, a desire to sort of do away with a lot of the institutions that some of us have believed are important in terms of keeping government from becoming way too powerful. At least those were the views of our founding fathers. Do you have a sense of which way this might go? And either way, could you perhaps comment on what it might mean in terms of our future, specifically, I guess, with respect to economics, the economic picture, how that might differ depending on which way the Senate tilts?
Yeah, I mean, stepping back from the current mass in Washington, what we have seen over any time slice, 25 years, 50 years, 100 years or more, is that crisis represents a period of time where the size and scale of government ratchets higher. And when crisis recedes, the governmental footprint does not. So
that's right.
And it's not an issue of right versus left, blue versus red. the reality is the role, the scope and scale of government tends to increase dramatically, the budget with it, of course, and then it does not scale back. So we have that yet again. We've got a health crisis, and, you know, certainly I'm encouraged to see death rates on the decline, even though we have case rates on the rise, and maybe with vaccines, this is something that's hopeful. Certainly, the stock market thinks that it's worth being hopeful for. But this is what we face in 2021: an increased scope and regimen for government, and that would have been the case either way. If Trump had won, it still would have been the case. We would have been just a little less heartburn, perhaps, amongst conservatives, and you know, obviously more heartburn on the other side of the aisle.
On the other side, yeah. But it, with respect to monetary and fiscal policy, what are your thoughts? I mean, would you see more fiscal policy, more probably, and less monetary, more reliance on fiscal if the Democrats control the Senate?
That'll be the key. So we get through the Georgia runoff, and we'll have a little bit more clarity on that. It would be a tough. The odds don't favor both seats going to the Democrats. So, and I think that may be what the markets are enthusiastic about too. Is they see kind of the hands tied in terms of real regulation, because I think there's some things that could absolutely strangle the markets. If you had the ability to increase taxes or whatnot. So, you know, the Senate, I think that's one of the real keys. Monetary policy is shown to be fairly ineffective, and fiscal policy, even with this week's announcements of a stimulus package, which I presume will be passed in large measure before the end of the year, because you've got the hot potato of over 10 million people losing all benefits, you know, which will cause a major hemorrhaging within the real estate markets, you know, as we go into January. And that's really not the tone that I think anyone wants to set. So will we see more after the $908 billion? Yeah, I think we will see a lot more. And, you know, fiscal policy will just be playing catch up with monetary policy. We're not going to be tightening monetary policy anytime soon.
No, it's pretty hard to see how that could work given the enormous amount of debt. The fact is, it seems to me that the Fed is trapped essentially. It can't allow rates to rise. It can't allow the markets to function and allocate capital as a free market would, and so
this, if you have you know, failure of the Democrats to win both of those seats, and we've got, you know, blue White House and red Senate, you know, there's not going to be an ability to raise taxes significantly, and I think that puts a lot of pressure downward on rates, where, you know, the only way to extract value and start the redistribution process is what they call financial repression, and that's just taking us down to zero. You know, you feel like you're at zero when, you know, 30-year mortgage is at 2.72%, the 10-year treasury is at 85 basis points. But even this week, we can remember that low can still go lower, and that's pretty well illustrated by Greek debt, Italian debt, you know, Spanish and Portuguese debt, you know, at or below zero, believe it or not, with countries that obviously are their credits mispriced. But that, I think, is something that we have to consider. It's very supportive to the metals prices, low negative real rates, but that is another form of value extraction. If you can't move tax policy, they'll get you, just a different way.
Yeah, it's really hard to see. Then what? Depending on, I mean, how are you and your team at Wealth Management planning 2021 and currently, how are you allocating? How are you suggesting to your clients they allocate their resources? And how, I mean, what's your portfolio look like? I know you've got gold in there. That's a given with the McIlvany, I think.
But yeah, vigorous debate. There's vigorous debate on the team.
That's
and
good.
We've had some productive meetings the last few weeks, but some hard fought meetings too. So, you know, what we're focusing on is process, position size, sector exposure, and cash allocation as a means of managing risk. And the process is what we're involved with constantly. Position size is really determining if we have too much exposure to any one company or sector. And of course, the sector exposure, we're trying to balance, particularly in our case, amongst four different areas of hard assets. And we do, as you mentioned, have as sort of a ballast exposure, a metals position. But I'd say, you know, having a healthy cash position coming into this next year, you can't be 100% cash. You can run an insane market much higher just on the basis of insane monetary policy. And I think you and I both have probably been in the category of folks that lacked an imagination for how high things like the Federal Reserve balance sheet could go. And maybe we think 10 trillion is an outside number. Maybe we discover next year that 10 on the way to 20, you know, we're just getting things started. So what are the possibilities? You know, the Bank of Japan just this week went ahead and marked to market $50 billion in gains on their equity portfolio. Yeah. And, you know, you've got folks at the Fed saying, why didn't we do that? We've been buying paper. We could actually be, you know, the equivalent of hedge fund heroes. Why didn't we buy this index or that index or this company or that company? And, you know, so I think the markets can go higher. And this is where there's debate on the team. My gut instinct is that we get to the middle of January, end of January, and we have the potential for having put in a top that remains the top for 2-3 years, in which case you could see a 30-40% decline from there. And, you know, so you have a tremendous amount of structural frailty within the financial markets, but they're juicing the system. And it's a very dangerous environment, a very dangerous environment. So where we're putting money to work, we're doing it very judiciously and pretty happy having a metals exposure and a healthy cash exposure, which today is, you know, at a minimum 30%, in some accounts as high as 42-43%, which is a reasonably high cash position for us.
42% cash.
At the outside.
It goes against Ray Dalio's ideas that cash is trash and so are bonds. And I get, you certainly would understand that. I mean, but cash for opportunities. So you're looking at the possibility of having a significant decline in the equity markets possibly. And it certainly is good to have cash when you see opportunities come along. I know how many times I've not had the cash when I wish I had. So from that perspective, it's certainly valuable to have it.
I think you have to look at the cash balance as an expression of opportunism as well as defense, you know, where you see, you know, the opportunity to add to positions, companies that we really like, and we're not at full allocation. So we haven't stepped into the market and just backed up the truck. And given financial market frailties, we do think we're going to have the opportunity to own a lot more of what we already like. And so the circumstances are such that we think that is going to be happening in the first quarter. Yeah, we could be wrong. Timing can get stretched out. But that's one of the reasons why we are still putting money to work, too. So that cash balance, regardless of any event driven, will be reduced between now and the, you know, end of the first quarter. Mm-hmm. Just because the markets can, as they say, the markets can remain irrational longer than you can solve it.
Yeah, that's for sure. You mentioned four sectors. So you have cash, you have gold, equities, general equities. Is that the other?
The four areas within our hard asset portfolios are infrastructure, specialty real estate, global natural resources, and precious metals, particularly the precious metals miners. And so those are four areas that provide both growth and income. When we occasionally allocate to the hard asset itself, not the miners, that's done to sort of balance our cash exposure. So with sensitivity to Dalio's cash is trash, we look and say, you know, look at our whole basket of quote-unquote liquidity, where a part of that is gold bullion and a part of that is greenbacks, and one kind of balances out the risk of the other, and maintains a broad – we still carry it under the broad category of liquidity.
What are your thoughts about Bitcoin?
I have a few. You know, it is, I think, one of the most, for me, it's an obvious expression of the speculative juices that are in the financial markets today. And it's one more expression of fast money, of easy money. You know, all of a sudden, gold up 20% or silver up 27%, even with this correction, that looks silly in comparison with 162% gain in Bitcoin. Who would want to own anything that was only up 30 or 40%? I mean, so when I talk to folks about Bitcoin and what their purchases have been with Bitcoin, it's pretty clear to me that it's fast money, it's make a quick buck. There's not a lot of strategic thinking, but there is a lot of intellectual backfilling to justify and buttress why they own it. Well, you know, it's like 21st century gold. Well, you know, it's going to replace gold. Well, you know, and it's really not, but all those legitimate references with the ancient barbaric relic, I think still hold. The value of gold in a portfolio is legitimate. And I'm not saying Bitcoin doesn't have a place in a portfolio, but I think of it as a lunch money investment. You know, where if you have 1% of a portfolio in something like that, it is in the category of a speculation. If it is going to be a currency someday, the best you can say is that today it's a very young currency. Mm-hmm. It has not matured. It is in no way a store of value or a means of exchange. You know, you still can't buy a cup of coffee with it, and maybe that changes. Right. So, mm-hmm. So as it matures, maybe it becomes more interesting. But I'm also guessing, Jay, that yeah. as it matures and as it really challenges the money monopoly, mm-hmm. what do you think the folks who have the money monopoly are going to say about that?
Well, exactly. Yeah.
And that's where I think that, you know, referencing back to Ken Rogoff, when he wrote his book, The Curse of Cash, mm-hmm. you know, he was all for moving to a digital-based, you know, society, or you don't have physical cash, so you'd think, well, digital's got to be the thing. This is what he said about Bitcoin. What the private sector may innovate, in due time, the government regulates and appropriates.
Yeah.
So the best case scenario is Bitcoin is a success, and then it's regulated and appropriated. and it's not what you thought it was. You went yeah. in thinking it's the greatest expression of monetary freedom we've seen in the 21st century, I would say, other than gold, and it ends up being something of a trap. I think there'll be some irony in that as it unfolds in time.
Certainly interesting. I know, David, when we spoke to you last, you don't buy into this idea that the dollar could be in trouble as the world's reserve currency. I think you see it, at least for the foreseeable future, as the major currency globally, right?
I mean, it's a difficult question in the sense that, yes, the dollar is doomed, but no, it's not going to die tomorrow. You know, and you see less interest in having it as a reserve asset. Who are the people who don't want to have it? You know, Turkey and Russia has been really interested in ditching the dollar and going to gold. Well, that's interesting. But that doesn't mean that our role as the world's reserve currency has changed. It's a long road before it's a short road. I forget which writer used to say, you know, in describing bankruptcy. How did you go bankrupt? Slowly, then all at once. I think that's the deal for the dollar. It's a slow process. Don't count on it, you know, going up in smoke tomorrow. But when it happens, it'll surprise you how quickly it happens. What you need is a replacement currency. You need something in line with sort of Thomas Kuhn's stories, as he describes it in The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. If you're going to have a shift in thinking on a particular idea, in this case, the world reserve currency hegemony, you have to have a replacement. What's the replacement idea? What's the replacement currency? Could have been the euro. Not really now. Could it be the RMB? Don't know. Maybe it is. But their capital markets aren't deep enough yet. Their bond markets aren't liquid enough yet for that to be the case. Mm-hmm. That takes time.
Yeah, it's going to take some time. And we're just about out of time.
I just want to say one thing on the dollar, because it just broke 92, which is a very critical support.
Yes. Uh-huh.
It's one of the things that is energizing, I think, an awareness amongst investors that no, gold is not done in this particular cycle. We sat at 92 last week on support, hit 91.7, now 91.28. And this is not a good story. This is not a good story at all if you're talking about the short-term technicals for the U.S. dollar. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons why I think gold's having a pretty strong move earlier this week.
Yeah, I think you're right. And certainly Michael Oliver, who is on our show almost every other week, says also that 91 is a key area, and he thinks we're going down to 85 on the index, so if we break that. So that would certainly put some wind at the backs of gold. And silver, I suppose you like a little better than gold in terms of its percentage possibilities on the upside. And what about copper with about 30 seconds left?
I do like copper. It's an area of emphasis for us, although getting a pure play is not altogether easy in terms of the quality of companies available. Silver is interesting. Through this whole correction, you've maintained a gold-silver ratio of about 77 to 1, which has been very healthy. Not a lot of deterioration in silver vis-a-vis gold, which has been very healthy. And this last week, even the mining shares only losing what the metals lost was a very good indication of support in the markets. So I would look at silver as having a strong move. We're at 75 to 1 now. Mm-hmm. That'll settle into the 40s. That may be this year, which would be quite an outperformance.
Wow. Boy, that would be great for silver, that's for sure. All right, well, that's it, David. That's all the time we have. Thank you so much for being with us once again. It's always a pleasure hearing your thoughts on the markets and beyond. So we'll look to talk to you again sometime soon, hopefully, and all the best to you and your family and your team there at the McIlvenny Group of Companies.
Thank you, Jay, and thanks for starting with that idea that we're custodians of a bigger general story.
Very important for joy and happiness and success in life, overall success, not just monetary success. Thank you so much. Well, folks, that is it for this week. Next week, Richard Mayberry will be with me, Michael Oliver, and Markel Rock of Cassier Gold Corp. Until then, goodbye, and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Novo Resources Corp. trades on the OTCQX under the symbol NSRPF and on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol NVO. Its flagship assets are located in the Pilbara region of Western Australia. Novo has recently partnered with Sumitomo Corporation of Japan to evaluate, advance, and develop the company's Australian gold projects. With over $40 million in cash and $60 million committed from Sumitomo, Novo is well on its way to establishing itself as one of the top junior explorers and developers in Australia.